All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 85 in this American History Program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. Today, or rather yesterday, we saw that the United States entered into a European war in 1914. So taking us back to our anchor fact timeline, we have President Woodrow Wilson, and we have World War I. Actually, America didn't enter into the war in 1914. It entered only in 1917. The war started in 1914, and it only entered in 1917. But the entrance of America into this war would have been unthinkable in the first century of American history, as we know, because the Founding Fathers were explicit and adamant that America, as a republic, were entrusted, the government entrusted with the protection of the rights of American citizens, should never get involved in the politics of Europe. Europe had its kings, it had its wars. These had nothing to do with America, nothing to do with the rights of Americans. And to participate in European wars would only amount to the American government ordering Americans to go die somewhere, which is basically the opposite of its responsibility to protect their right to life, most fundamentally. So this would have, the idea of going into it and getting involved in a European war would have been unfathomable in early American history because of the influence of the Founding Fathers. But we saw that over the past couple classes that starting in 1898, America was beginning to act in a different manner. It was turning into an international police power. And the other president that really plays a crucially important role in this transformation is depicted here on the right, is Theodore Roosevelt. And he's the first one to use that expression, to say that America should be an international police power. And he even went so far as to claim in his 1905 speech called the Roosevelt Corollary, he went so far as to claim that being a police power was actually a way of following the Monroe Doctrine. He said that America should intervene in the affairs of certain countries. He was trying to be a little bit tricky there and say in the affairs of the Americas. Remember, he was trying to justify interference in Panama so that Europeans would not. So that was his way of trying to recast the Monroe Doctrine into a reason for intervening rather than a reason for not intervening. So, but as we saw yesterday, there's no way to look at World War I and stretch, supposedly, the Monroe Doctrine to include that. There's no way to take a war that basically has to do with these countries and say that there's a version of the Monroe Doctrine that says that it's correct in any sense for America to go get involved there. So when President Woodrow Wilson decided he wanted America to police Europe, he had to come up with a new reason why. There was no way for him to make a Wilson corollary. That's what it would have amounted to, attempting to make a Wilson's corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, which says that in cases where Europe is in trouble, well, then we will get involved. So, no way to do that. So he had to come up with basically a new policy. He had to repudiate the Monroe Doctrine, in effect, explicitly, completely, and find a way to get Americans to buy into that. Find a way to characterize what America was going to do in such a way that Americans would accept it. How did he do it? How did he get this country of people used to and happy to be apart from the wars of others, how did he get Americans to say, let's go fight in Europe? What was his convincing argument? Because he got it. He stood before Congress in 1917. He made a speech, and Congress voted to declare war. Used to be, that's how America goes to war. In the Constitution of the United States, the country cannot go to war without Congress voting for it. A president, for instance, cannot take the country to war. That's against the law. Now, interestingly, American presidents have been taking the United States to war throughout the 20th century. And so that's, again, part of the reason why I don't think we can call America a republic anymore, because just the way that Americans are acting just continues to change, and that's one of them. But in World War I, I believe is the last time World War II also, a different situation, but the president stood before Congress and asked for a declaration of war and got it. Why? Why did Congress say, we're going to do this now? We're going to go against the entire history of our country and the meaning of the country that the founders explained. Why? Well, if you need help, let's go back to this. What's the reason, Keen?
Well, there were the leading things that led up to it, sort of practically. The Lusitania was sunk. The Americans were killed, and then there was Zimmerman telegram. But then what's there at the bottom of what you wrote? The world must be safe for democracy. It sounds pretty good. And for, as you said yesterday, for the generation that didn't know war, that sounds pretty good, and it sounds like it might be worth going to war if the world can be made safe for democracy.
That's a really good point, Keen. That's what I was asking you for here, was to understand how it's possible for a president to stand before the country and make a convincing argument as to why its citizens should go fight somewhere, right? I mean, that's gotta be convincing. Because even in the abstract, the idea of going to other people, to some other part of the world, and possibly dying there, right? You gotta have a reason. And so he said, this is the reason. We want to fight for the ultimate peace of the world. This is possibly the most colossal presumption in the history of mankind, that a president would say that there's going to be peace in the world. Because anybody who's ever studied history knows that what is history full of? Guess what? It's not peace. Hint, hint. What is the nearest thing to a constant in human history, Timothy?
History is full of repeating itself, and it keeps repeating barbaric stuff happening and a bunch of wars and...
Yeah, exactly.
Keeps repeating that.
Yeah, yeah. So not to dance around it. War. It's full of wars. Wherever you look, it doesn't have to do with any particular civilization, but you look in Chinese history, it's full of wars. Indian history, full of wars. The history of the Middle East, full of wars. The history of Europe, full of wars. American history, full of wars. So here we have a president who's standing up in front of the world, and he's saying, we're going to fight for the ultimate peace of the world. So in a way, it's, how can you say such a thing? Do you really think, I mean, you're saying to Americans they're going to achieve this? That there's going to be peace? So it's kind of a wild claim, an impossible claim. And yet, it's not just peace. I mean, he's got an idea, and this is really significant. Woodrow Wilson was very educated. I think he had a PhD in history. Just because you have your credentials doesn't mean you understand anything, but he was very educated, very intelligent. And he is saying here that democracy will be the means. Okay, this is what he's saying. We're going to fight for the ultimate peace of the world. We're going to make the world safe for democracy. This was his premise. This was absolutely the European ideal, that if governments could just be made democratic, there would be no more wars. What do you think? True, false? Is democracy the antidote to war? Let's put it that way. That's the premise. Alexander?
I don't think so, because in Athens, they had democracy, they still fought wars.
Okay, and then we have the other example. Yeah, now that you could... You'd have to, be careful of that case, right? Because Athens was the only democracy, or there were a couple other Greek city-states that were kind of tinkering in their own ways there. But the fact that they fought Persia was an empire. The fact that they fought Sparta was not democratic. So you could look at those cases and you'd say, well, that's not Athens that's responsible for those wars. It's the countries that are non-democratic. And so you could make the case that actually is not a good counter-argument. But just thinking about what democracy is, does it contain within it as a premise, as a concept, does it contain the solution to wars? If it's not that hard to sort out. Because democracy means what? Everybody's hand goes up. Democracy is what, Declan? This has to be a reflex now. Cliff, what is democracy?
Majority rule.
Okay, so tell me, is that an antidote to war?
No.
Why not?
Well, just because different people in the different countries may vote for different things, and that doesn't mean that they'll agree on everything.
Okay, and if a country is a democracy, how does it go to war? The same way everything else happens in a democracy.
They vote to go to war.
And if the majority wants war, what happens?
Then they go to war.
Then they go to war. Okay, so do we have some kind of magic pill here that's called democracy? And if you take that, there's no more war? No, absolutely not. Majority rules is the concept democracy. So there's a kind of idealism here that says, oh, if people are just in charge of their governments, they won't choose war. We say, we'll have more stable governments where people won't do that. They just won't pick that kind of thing. Now, I have to say that history has been pretty kind in this regard overall. If you do look at the record of governments throughout history, and you compare the record of democratic governments with non-democratic governments, the record is good. So it's true that if you look, for instance, at World War I, it was not started by the more democratic governments, such as France and England. It was started by the empires, Germany and Austria. So that would, you could, it's not completely implausible that democracy is a good way of impeding this impulse to war that seems to be a constant. So it's not entirely implausible, but in just purely logically, by looking at what democracy is, there is nothing within the concept that negates war. It just means that you have a certain mechanism for deciding things in your culture, and that can lead to war, as in other ways. It does make it perhaps less likely, but certainly not impossible. And we're about to encounter a new case, one of the strongest examples in history of a war that is triggered by a country that basically had become a democracy. So we're going to get there. All right, so right, now I wanted to go back to what Keane said earlier, because there was another element of what he said that was really useful. So on the one hand, we have this premise, the world must be made safe for democracy, and that's what Keane was saying is kind of like the positive ideal, this good thing. It's like, oh, yeah, if that's a good reason to go fight. Wouldn't we want to have peace? Wouldn't we want other people to have democracy? Isn't that better? So there's a kind of ideal involved there. But on the other hand, Keane also mentioned the precedents that were tugging at Americans and saying, you know, this is what it means. If, you know, we did this in Cuba, we did this in Philippines, we did this in Panama. This is what being a police power looks like. Now, one thing about those precedents is that they created a little bit of an illusion that combines up with the other thing that Keane said, which was Americans didn't really have an experience at war. Can you kind of see how this was going to set them up for a really, really painful time in World War I? The way that America had intervened in Cuba and then the Philippines and then in Panama was pretty much the only experience Americans had at doing this, at policing the world. And these were kind of misleading examples. So if anybody had any idea of what it was going to be like to go to Europe and fight a war there, what kind of idea would they have based on these three precedents? Now, we didn't study the details of them very much, but we didn't study them because we didn't need to. There were none. America just basically easily won those. America was much more powerful than its adversaries in these cases. So they were easy. They were easy, and Americans kind of felt good about the outcome as well. Remember, we've got Theodore Roosevelt, and we've got this campaign poster that characterizes American rule in Cuba, and doesn't it look nice? Doesn't it make you feel good that the Cubans have teachers, and they can grow their own food, and they've got factories, and all that's because of America? So, that kind of makes you feel good about being a world police power. You're helping others. And so it seems like a kind of benevolent type of thing to do. So all of this was part of the lead up to World War I. And there wasn't a real understanding of what would be involved. And World War I had to do with, you know, going back to these powers here. These were all great powers. America was beginning to emerge in 1914. It was kind of joining the club of great powers, and the ones that are labeled here were already great powers. So by World War I, America was probably more powerful than any of these. Certainly its economy was already the largest in the world. And it was already more powerful than any of these. But it was, you know, far away, right? There's the whole Atlantic Ocean between America and Europe. If America is going to participate in this war, it's going to have to transport its troops all the way to Europe and join the war in that kind of difficult scenario against these great powers. So this was a new situation, very challenging, very difficult, requiring everything that America had to give, basically, which it did. By the time World War I was over, the United States had transported over 2 million people to Europe in the span of about 2 years. And it's a staggering number. Think about the migration of 2 million, mostly soldiers, across the Atlantic Ocean within 2 years. At a rate of about 1 million a year, people crossing the Atlantic. It's a staggering number. It's the kind of thing that's only possible, of course, in the Industrial Revolution. You couldn't try to imagine the Mayflower. How many voyages of the Mayflower would it take to get 2 million people across the ocean? How many hundreds of years would that take? I don't know. But America did it in 2 years with its fleets of ships, and 2 million Americans were sent to Europe. And by the time the war was over, well, the more negative side of things here is, the casualties were 117,000 dead. 117,000 Americans dead. 200,000 wounded. Just going to bring up another, just kind of a symbolic image here more than anything else. It's definitely, it's a very touching thing. I don't know so much for your generation, but for mine and for older people, for these cemeteries in Europe in which you find all of these Americans row by row buried there, and it's just these giant cemeteries. And for Americans, this is just a staggering number. Now, here's an interesting comparison to make. In the War on Terror, America invaded Iraq and quite easily won that particular conflict. And the number of casualties there is approximately 4,000. So America's a country that's got 300 million people in it, and only about 4,000 troops died in Iraq. So you can see why it's not, we don't have quite the cultural scar from that type of a conflict than people do from World War I. I mean, America might have been a third the size, maybe about 100 million people. The casualties were 30 times greater. So we're talking about a relative impact of the war, about 100 times what the war in Iraq had on American culture. And you know that American culture was deeply conflicted over the war in Iraq, and so much so that it was a really big factor in President Obama being elected, because he promised change. And imagine what it was like for Americans back after World War I with a relative impact to their country about 100 times greater. What did they want? I mean, the pain was immense. The impact, the injury to America as a nation was amazing and shocking. And so when Americans now were coming face to face for the first time with what it really would mean to be an international police power and to go and to try to fight for the ultimate peace of the world, now there was no illusion. And now there was no way to pretend, there was no way to look at that and treat it as if it was just some kind of vague ideal. What it meant was hundreds of thousands of Americans dead. And of course, this is just one war, mostly in Europe. What about the rest of the world that needs to be cleaned up? What's the death toll going to be there? Well, we don't even have to wonder, because we are going to see. But back then, you know, they had to wonder still. They had to imagine it, and they did not like what they were imagining. So after World War I, Americans voted for a new president named Warren Harding. Just because we can bring it up here. Done looking at Theodore Roosevelt now. Can just look up for Warren Harding. There he is. And so he was elected after World War I, so he became president in 1921. And his promise was this. There it is. There's his promise to Americans. A return to normalcy. So, it's very understandable, right? The shock of the war was something that Americans were really, they were reeling from. And by return to normalcy, he meant, of course, going back to the normal way of life, the American way of life. And Americans definitely were eager for that. They did not want to have to suffer the type of pain that World War I had caused them ever again. Unfortunately, despite the intentions of Harding and despite the powerful preference of Americans, they were going to be involved in more wars around the world, and including, of course, as we know, World War II. So now we have to look at, how is that possible? How is it possible that Americans had, tinkered with this idea of being a world police power, found it to be abhorrent, backed away from it, demanded a return to normalcy, and yet, 30 years later, are back at war? Or like 20 years, sorry. 20 years later, they're back at war. Literally, because Harding takes office in 1921, America joins World War II in 1941. So how is this possible? So we have to go back. Now, this is going to be kind of a whirlwind tour of what happened between the wars, because the essence of what happened between World War I and World War II is a European story. So I'm not going to go into radical detail here, too much detail into the story. So I'm going to just sweep through it, just give you the essence of it. So the essence of it is that Wilson's idea that democracy leads to peace is wrong. That's the essence. Because basically, at the end of World War I, what Wilson wanted more than anything else was for Germany to be a democracy. He felt that that would stabilize all of Europe. So at the end of the war, with America bearing down on it, the Germans overthrew their monarch. The Kaiser, he was called, or that was his title anyway. They overthrew the monarch and established democracy. So everybody thought, well, Wilson thought, this is great. And what we need to do is not, we need to welcome Germany into the community of democratic nations, and we'll have peace. So, at the end of the war, he insisted that Germany not be invaded. He insisted that it was called peace without victory. That Germany would be allowed to reclaim its place among the nations of the world, except this time it would be a genuine democracy, and as a result, it would not be an aggressive country. The rest of the European countries wanted to invade Germany and destroy it, because they had suffered enormously. I mean, you think about Americans' casualties, 117,000 dead. France had 1.4 million dead. So you can understand why they, had previous wars with Germany, wanted Germany punished. But they didn't get their way, because they couldn't do it without America's help. So instead of punishing Germany by invading it, what they insisted was Germany should pay penalties, monetary penalties, to the other countries of Europe for what it had done. Because when they looked at World War I, going back to our map here for a second, here's basically how it happened. They looked at this. Remember, we had Sarajevo over here, right? So the Austrian crown prince is killed in Sarajevo by a Serbian. So they looked at this and they said, okay, what happened was Austria wanted to attack Serbia. Now, that's going to be a tiny war. You got a big empire. It's going to swallow Serbia. It's over. That's not a world war. But what happened was Russia said, you can't do that. Well, actually, didn't quite say that. They said more like, well, yeah, pretty much. Russia said, don't do that. We're on Serbia's side. And Austria said, well, Germany, what about you? You are our ally. And Germany had said, don't worry. We got your back. If Russia attacks you, we're going to take care of Russia. So this is how the war got started, because Austria-Hungary said, okay, we're going to take out Serbia, and Germany's going to help us to fight Russia, and so we're okay. Our allies are on our side. We're going to do it. So Germany was the first of the powers to actually expand the war from a tiny war down here into a big war. And as soon as that happened, Germany attacked the Western countries as well, because they knew there were alliances. So they said, we're not going to wait for these guys to decide what to do. We're going to attack them. So Germany was very obviously responsible for expanding what would have been a really small war into a really big one. And for most people, that was the equivalent to being responsible for the war, which I think is a pretty fair assessment. So they said, Germany, you're responsible. You got to pay. We're not going to invade you. We're not going to destroy your country, but you got to pay for this war. And so they got America to agree, and Germany started paying these penalties called reparations to the rest of the countries. But the German people were really upset about that. They didn't believe that they were responsible. They didn't accept responsibility. And so they shirked on the payments. They stopped paying. And they voted for a leader who told them that they weren't responsible and it wasn't their fault. Here he is. Let's go down. There he is. In 1933, they elected Adolf Hitler. And his main point, I mean, the reason why they liked him, the reason why they voted for him, was because he told them that it wasn't their fault, that they were not in the wrong. It was the rest of Europe that was being unfair to the German nation. And that Germany had a right to become a great power in the world, and everybody else was wrong. So in 1933, in one of the other of the very powerful examples of democracy going wrong, in 1933, the Germans voted for Hitler and created the Third Reich. 1933, did I say? Right? So yeah, history is full of examples. No, I won't say full. History has a number of really powerful examples that demonstrate how dangerous democracy is. It also has a number of examples of democracy being fairly benign. So that's what's challenging about democracy is if you don't know history, then you can't really weigh these properly, these cases. You can't look at ancient Athens and the death of Socrates. You can't look at popular sovereignty, democracy by slavery by democracy in America. You can't look at Germany and the voting for Hitler and the formation of the Third Reich by the Germans democratically. You can't kind of pierce through to those examples and all you see is the good. And that makes kind of democracy seem like the best thing there is. It's not. And it's important to learn these things, because democracy was supposed to be the antidote to European war, and instead it led to the next European war. The Germans wanted it. The majority of Germans wanted it. And so they got it. Now, when Americans saw this happening, when they saw Adolf Hitler get elected in 1933, form the Third Reich, and start repudiating these penalties and starting to build up the German military and basically start, you know, creating a new threat to the peace of Europe, Americans, they could see what was going to happen. They recognized this. And they passed a new set of laws in 1935 called the Neutrality Acts. They said, basically, we're not getting involved in that. We saved Europe once, and now we see a trend that is Very frightening. We see another Imperial German power rising up with the same message, only worse. We see this Adolf Hitler character telling the Germans that their greatness lies in an imperial future. And they're buying it. They like him. And they are obviously up to no good, so we don't want to be involved again. So in 1935, the United States government passed the Neutrality Acts, basically saying, if Europe goes to war, America will be neutral. So even in 1935, America is not entirely committed to this idea, right, of being an international police power. It's still very conflicted because of the negative effects of World War I. So America tried to stay out. Tried. And the war starts in 1939. Early on in the war, I don't have a good set of maps yet for World War II. I think I have one set of maps, which I'm not entirely happy with. It's in German, so don't try to read it. And so you got Germany in the center with Italy as an ally and secretly Russia as an ally, at the beginning anyway. And then you have these other, you know, France and England again on the other side, with Poland, unfortunately, sandwiched in between two bullies. And later on, Russia changes sides. But at first, it was on the same side as Hitler. Anyway, I got to generate some maps of my own here for this purpose. But again, it's a European war, primarily. Except, in this case, and this is the reason why America was forced into the war, there was an Asian component to this war, which was kind of a new feature of it. Not only now was there Germany wanting to become this great imperial power in Europe, but there was Japan over in Asia becoming basically taking on the same role, looking at East Asia and saying, that's the way to be a great country in the world. Having suffered under European aggression for centuries, the Japanese were deciding, all right, we need to be an empire as well. So they allied with Germany, and this is why we get America in World War II, despite itself. Because the Japanese looked at America across the Pacific Ocean, and they said, America's neutral for now. But they basically, they were good at their history, unlike Wilson. They were good at their history. They looked at America and they said, the United States does not want to get involved, but we can predict with a reasonable degree of certainty that they will anyway, despite themselves or despite their preference not to get involved. They probably will. They just can't seem to help themselves. And especially lately, we saw how they got involved in World War I, and we see that they are entangled in all of these affairs. Eventually, they're going to get involved. So the Japanese reasoned, all right, since America is going to get involved at some point, we're better off crippling them before they're really involved. So this infamy is what brings the United States into the war, because Japan attacks the American naval base in Hawaii, called Pearl Harbor, and at that point, there's no choice. For 2 years, the United States had not been involved in the war, but now there was no choice. It was in, and it was going to fight both Japan and Germany. So that's what we'll look at on Monday. We'll look at what World War II was. It was, of course, the greatest cataclysm in human history, with tens of millions dead. America plays the most important role in that war. And the outcome of World War II is that Americans decide, well, we can't do this again, right? Every time there's a terrible outcome to being the world police power, Americans say, we can't do that again. So after World War II, they said, we can't do that again. So what are we going to do? Are we going to just withdraw again? And then, of course, you know what will happen. the Europeans will just fight another war and we'll have to save them again. So instead of letting the Europeans mess things up over and over and over again, what we'll do is we'll stay. We will police Europe from now on. We will become, we'll set up military bases, we'll create alliances, and we will police the situation so that we don't get these kinds of things happening again. So this is going to be the next step, where America becomes this permanent police power, entangled and enmeshed in the affairs of everybody else, to stop them from getting into big wars. Because the big wars are really, really destructive. So the new police power approach is to stop the big wars from happening. So we'll see that next week. Alrighty. That'll do it for today. We'll do history throughout tomorrow. Thanks, folks. Bye for now.
Bye, Mr. Powell.
Bye.
Bye.